Welcome to Fredericksburg Battlefield. You have an uncommon opportunity today to walk the battlefield with Frank O'Reilly, a National Park Service historian who probably knows more about the Battle of Fredericksburg than anybody in the world. We recorded Frank as he walked the sunken road with some visitors in April of 2009. Because he was in front of a live audience, he wasn't paying particular attention to directions or distances, so we'll provide that information for you as you go along. We suggest you begin the tour in the grassy area at the north end of the parking lot just behind the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center. Go there, turn your machine back on, and we'll get started with the tour.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. My name is Frank O'Reilly. I'm one of the historians on the park staff here. And we're going to take a short walk down along the historic sunken road and the stone wall, which was the first line in the Confederate defense at Fredericksburg. The ground we're going to cover is extremely significant. Almost 9,000 soldiers wound up as casualties within two blocks of where we're standing right now. And by the time the battle was over, both Union and Confederate soldiers called the Confederate defenses here the impregnable position, the perfect defense, the Gibraltar of the South. But historians are a bit cynical. We don't believe anything is really perfect. And so there are a number of things that don't work quite right here on the Confederate defense at the stone wall. So as we go along, I want to show you some examples of what worked for the Confederates, what didn't work for the Confederates, and what the Confederates had to change or alter to make it work, so that by the time the battle was over, everybody thought it was a perfect defense. A little bit of background. As you look at the ground around you, Fredericksburg has changed dramatically since the time of the battle. Out in front of you are nothing but houses. But in 1862, there was about 900 yards of open field between us and the edge of the city. It was an open ground without any trees, fences, houses, cover of any sort. And that would be the killing field at Fredericksburg. It was inevitable that there was going to be a battle here at Fredericksburg. Fredericksburg has a very dubious distinction of being the midpoint between the two opposing capitals. Washington, D.C. is just 50 miles north of us, and Richmond, the capital of the Confederacy, is just 50 miles south. If you draw a straight line between the two, you inevitably wind up here at Fredericksburg. The Union Army wanted Fredericksburg. They needed Fredericksburg as a springboard on their drive south to capture Richmond. The idea being that the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. And if they drive south along the axis of Fredericksburg, just by their position, they not only threaten the Confederate capital, but they are protecting Washington at the exact same time. So, of course, politicians like that idea in Washington and are quick to endorse a program with Fredericksburg. Now, the Confederates also needed Fredericksburg because they needed to keep the Union Army as far away from Richmond as possible. And they had a nice natural ally to help them here. And that is the Rappahannock River that runs across our front. It is a belt across the state of Virginia, so that any Union soldiers driving south to Richmond have to cross that river. It's going to slow them down. It's going to bottleneck their advance and give the Confederates an opportunity in which they can mass up their forces and crowd the Union Army up against the river. They're going to do this time and time again from 1862 to 1864. But the first time they get to experiment with that is right here in the fall of 1862. At that time, Abraham Lincoln was desperate for a military victory. The preliminary Emancipation Proclamation was issued in the fall of 1862. It was an ultimatum to the South, saying that if they renounced secession before January 1st and came back into the Union, they would discuss their problems within the framework of the government. If the Confederacy did not renounce its independence, then the Emancipation Proclamation would be signed into law on January 1st, and the slaves will be free. The only way that the Emancipation Proclamation was ever going to have any legitimacy, any teeth, was through military victory. The only way Lincoln was going to be able to silence his political critics was through military victory. So with that in mind, he is going to push every single field army across this nation forward in an offensive during the winter of 1862. The biggest and most high-profile of them all was the one here in Virginia. It was called the Army of the Potomac. They were 135,000 men, and they were led by Ambrose Everett Burnside. Now, General Burnside was specifically selected because he was an aggressive officer. He was very assertive and very decisive. And that is precisely what the president needed. Burnside had a plan. He proposed to bring his army directly here to Fredericksburg and drive south. When he got the approval of the president, he was marching within 24 hours. Quick, decisive, assertive. He arrived here 2 days later and caught the Confederates entirely off guard. There weren't 1,000 Confederates anywhere near the city of Fredericksburg to stop Burnside's advance. But Burnside was stopped nonetheless, not by the Confederates, but by the Rappahannock River. Burnside had ordered up pontoon bridge material to be waiting for him here so that he could cross the river without missing a beat. But one of the great bureaucratic snafus of the war left him high and dry on the wrong side of the river with no bridges. The bridges would eventually arrive about 2 weeks later. And by that time, this entire picture had changed. Robert E. Lee and the Confederate Army of Northern Virginia now understood what Burnside was doing and could block his path south. Lee quickly marshaled about 78,000 Confederates here opposite Fredericksburg, and they loved the lay of the ground. Not only had the river done its job, but immediately behind the city was this wide open field of 900 yards, and then on the far side of it, this abrupt hill, Marie's Heights, which juts up immediately behind you. It forms a platform that completely dominates that open ground, and it's part of a series of ridges that extend for 2 miles to the north until it meets a bend in the Rappahannock River. And it's also part of a series of ridges that extend for 6 miles to the south until it peters off into a swamp called the Massaponics. Both ends of the Confederate line were anchored on water so that the Union Army could not go around them. The only way for Burnside's army to get to Richmond from here is to go over that hill. And Robert E. Lee knew it and built a defense to take advantage of that. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a walk through an area of severe fighting, intensely concentrated combat, and look at what worked for the Confederates and what didn't work for the Confederates and how they were able to overcome that to make, again, what people thought was the perfect defense.
From the north end of the parking lot, we suggest you step up into the sunken road through the break in the wall and stop at the exhibit just inside the wall.
If you had been here in the fall and winter of 1862, you would have seen this road packed with Confederate infantrymen, men from the deep south who had never been this far north in their lives. And they were in a unique situation where you had Confederates along a stone wall glaring at a Union army across the river, which in turn was glaring back at them, both sides waiting for someone to do something. And they're going to have to wait until the second week of December in 1862. At that point, Burnside had his bridges in hand, and he had another plan. Burnside set his target at Fredericksburg itself, hoping that if he could quickly lay down pontoon bridges, move a force across the river, and seize this hill, Marie's Heights, before the Confederates could react and concentrate their forces, then theoretically he could punch a hole right through the Confederate defenses and maybe isolate a part or a wing of the Confederate army. But everything relies on speed and surprise. Both of those things fell apart on December 11th, 1862. When engineers attempted to throw down bridges opposite the city, Confederate sharpshooters led by a maverick officer from Mississippi named William Barksdale opened fire on them. He held the Union Army at bay for hours on end. Union artillery opened fire on the city trying to drive them away. Whole blocks went up in flames, but the Confederates tenaciously clung to the rubble. Now, the Confederates who were located out here along the sunken road on December 11th had a very impressionable day because they literally had a ringside seat to all the sights and the sounds of the fight downtown. And some of the soldiers wrote letters that day from this area. One of them was a lieutenant from Georgia named William Montgomery, and he wrote a letter to his aunt saying, "It would have made your blood run cold to see their vast numbers coming across to oppose our brave but little band." Lieutenant Montgomery had a point. There were about 3,500 Georgians along this sunken road and stone wall. Pouring into the city opposite them were almost 35,000 Union soldiers. The Georgians were outnumbered 10 to 1, and Lieutenant Montgomery didn't like the odds. Curiously, Lieutenant Montgomery's commander also wrote a letter about that same time. And he had a much different impression. His name was Brigadier General Thomas Reed Roots Cobb. And Cobb wrote to his wife, not about his blood running cold, but instead he told her, "We can hear their bands and drums plainly, and it makes my blood boil to hear them." Well, that has a much different connotation to it, doesn't it? In this case, he wasn't upset or nervous. He was anxious to punish the Union Army. And he thought he had the perfect vehicle right here, with this sunken road and this stone wall. But granted, I will be the first one to admit, this doesn't look very much like a sunken road. But there are elements or aspects of it that are indeed sunken. Basically, this was one of the principal north-south highways across the state of Virginia in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s. So much traffic had piled through here that erosion literally saw the road sink and the hillside to fall off. People in Fredericksburg started putting stone retaining walls out here to keep mud from sliding into the road. Then they also added walls on this side, or the city side, as a visual deterrent or perhaps as a genuine barrier, so that whatever was using the fields wouldn't stray into the traffic, whatever was on the road wouldn't stray into the field. Whatever its real purpose was, in 1862, its purpose became decidedly military. Because the Confederates along this road were going to use this stone wall as a buffer, as a protection. The Confederates who occupied this spot had a pre-built, ready-made stone-lined trench that was going to keep them safe during the Battle of Fredericksburg. In contrast to this, remember out in front, 900 yards of vast open field. So Union soldiers entering into that field are going to be a stark and easy target to the Confederates who are standing here in December of 1862. There was no place for them to hide. There was no cover for them to take. And every step in that open field would be visible, and they could anticipate every move they make. Another thing that General Cobb was thinking about here is that, believe it or not, he had too many Georgians along this sunken road. Of the 3,500 troops here, not all of them could level their rifles across this wall and fire simultaneously. In some areas, they were stacked up two or three deep. So General Cobb had them set up relays in which the man at the wall would constantly fire, and the men behind him would do nothing but load weapons and pass them forward. That would pick up their speed and enhance their firepower and make them even deadlier. And then one last thing to think about, and that is this large hill behind you, Marye's Heights. It's not very tall, but the slope is very abrupt, and that was significant for a battlefield. Typically, soldiers fight on relatively flat ground so that the front line can fire at will, but the second or third lines have to wait their turn before they can fire. But here at Fredericksburg, we have Georgians along the sunken road that can fire at will. But there are also troops posted on the crest of Marye's Heights, North Carolinians, South Carolinians, and they can fire at will right over the heads of the Georgians. There was also artillery posted on the crest of the hill. Lieutenant Montgomery was worried about the math. 3,500 Georgians versus 35,000 Union soldiers. But General Cobb was satisfied with the geography, because we have two front lines that can fire simultaneously. That said, there are still some problems and there are some concerns about these positions. One of those who was deeply concerned about this spot was General Robert E. Lee. He wasn't sure if this was a strong enough position. Moments before the battle even began, Robert E. Lee and his chief lieutenant, General James Longstreet, they sent a note down to General Cobb saying that if he would like to pull back, they will cover for him immediately. Cobb sent a rather irreverent response back saying that if the generals will wait for me, they will wait a damn long time. What we're going to do now is go see exactly how Cobb used this position to his benefit.
Frank's next stop is at the site of the Martha Stevens House, just 100 yards or so down the road to the north, on your right-hand side. You'll see some exhibits at the spot.
Okay, we are about halfway down General Cobb's line. The stone wall came from this spot equally in one direction as it did the other. It was a fairly mundane landscape here in 1862. The only thing that broke up the monotony of the stone wall and the sunken road was just a few houses that were here at the time of the battle. One of them is still standing on the corner. That's known as the Innes House, the one with the siding on it. Another, you can see the foundation immediately in front of you, was known as the Martha Stevens House. And this was where General Cobb made his headquarters during the Battle of Fredericksburg. Now, General Burnside had committed himself to fighting at Fredericksburg. He'd worked so hard to break into the city of Fredericksburg that he just couldn't leave without taking the next step of trying to break out of the city and on to Richmond. The Confederate line, though, posed a problem to him. 78,000 Confederates ringed him in and hemmed him up against the river. The Confederates took advantage of the high hills all around Fredericksburg, but the nature of the hills was unique. The Confederate line was not a straight battle line, but in fact a concave line with its center bowed away from the Union Army and away from the Rappahannock River. Because of the nature of this line, both Robert E. Lee and Ambrose Burnside knew exactly where the Union Army could attack and where it could not attack. The Union Army was never going to attack the center of Lee's line where it was most recessed. To venture into that area would subject them to a crossfire from several different angles, which left Burnside with only two choices: either end of the Confederate line where it came forward towards the Union Army. These bulges in the line are known in military parlance as salients. They're a little harder to defend because the troops inside a salient can only diffuse their fire outward from a spot where the attackers can hit it from several different angles and concentrate their fire inward. We are on one of those salients right now. The Stonewall and Marye's Heights jut out from the main Confederate line. And that's part of the reason why Robert E. Lee wasn't sure he wanted to keep it. So, the question was, how can Burnside win at Fredericksburg? Because the Confederate line is anchored as it is, there is no going around it, there was no going through the center of it, it would have to go through one of the bulges, either the north end bulge, where we're standing now at the sunken road, or the southern bulge, an area known as Prospect Hill. The Union Army targeted the southern bulge as their principal attack, but they felt an obligation to attack this spot as well. They attacked the southern end of the Confederate line to win the battle, but they attacked the northern end of the line to keep the Confederates here so occupied that they could not bleed off reinforcements to the south and contain a Union breakthrough. No Union soldiers ever sent against this spot ever entertained the hope of winning the battle here. It simply couldn't be done.
For the next segment, there's no reason to move. Frank's just going to shift his attention to the first Union attacks of the battle.
On the morning of December 13th, at about 10 o'clock, a very dense fog that shrouded the Rappahannock Valley suddenly burned off, and the Confederates along the sunken road were treated to an amazing sublime sight. Across this open field, on the edge of the city of Fredericksburg, were three long lines of Union infantry, one right behind the other. Burnside intended to attack this very spot. At 11 o'clock, that first line very deliberately set off, heading across the field directly for this point. 300 yards behind that first line came the second line, and 300 yards behind that line was the third. General Burnside never thought the first line was ever going to get here. He knew that the Confederates would give it their undivided attention, and they would take so many casualties that inevitably they would have to stop short of their goal. But he hoped that they would get as far as they could across this field before they laid down and returned fire. If they kept the Confederates focused on them, fixated on them, that will allow the second line to move relatively untouched. So that by the time it got as far as the first line, it was still in good shape. With its leadership, its organization, and with momentum, it would keep on going. But as soon as they took that first step beyond the prostrate figures of the initial attack, they were going to bear the brunt of all the Confederate fire. They probably weren't going to get here either. That's why Burnside placed all his faith on the third line, hoping that it would get as far as the first line in good shape, the second line intact and with momentum, keep on going, and get here. It's called a wave assault. And it has been as old as the military itself and is still in vogue even today. At 11 o'clock, these Union soldiers started across the field. The Confederates here simply couldn't believe it. They were overwhelmed with emotion. Many of them jumped up and started cheering simply because it was such an exciting picture to behold. Others started shooting indiscriminately at it because it was so immense they could not see how they would miss. But the Union Army was 900 yards away, and the effective range of a rifle is about 300 yards. It was a complete waste of ammunition, and General Cobb got a bit peeved at that. He stepped down into the road and ordered silence. He wanted the Union Army to come closer. As the first line advanced to within 300 yards of this spot, they had already been chewed up by artillery, but they persisted and kept coming. When they got to 300 yards, the artillery abruptly stopped firing. The hill behind you is so abrupt that the cannons could not depress their tubes and fire downward into the area immediately in front of us. But as soon as the cannons quit, the Confederate infantrymen with their rifles along the sunken road had them in their beads. But Cobb refused to let them fire. He wanted them to come closer. He let them advance to within 200 yards of us, and along the road there was nothing but silence. When they advanced to within 100 yards of us, General Cobb took his hat and waved it to get everyone's attention on the road, and then yelled at the top of his lungs, "Get ready, boys, here they come. Fire." With that, there was a volley that came ripping out from behind the wall, followed by a second and a third. Remember, these guys were stacked up back here. In fact, they kept up a constant fire for the next 10 minutes. And this entire landscape was completely obliterated in gun smoke. At the end of 10 minutes, Cobb ordered a ceasefire to let the smoke dissipate so they can see the effect. When the smoke disappeared, they discovered that first Union line had all but disappeared as well. Much of it was lying dead and wounded immediately in front of this spot. The survivors broke, and they fled back towards the city. But the fire here was so devastating, they couldn't even get back to the city. They had to throw themselves down on the ground and find any kind of shelter available. But there was nothing out there in that vast open field. Except about 300 yards from us was a tiny little ripple in the ground, a tiny little ditch, a swale, that if a man laid down, he would have cover. These men threw themselves into that swale, and they became trapped. They could not go forward, and now they could not go back either. The second line advanced. They got as far as the first line, met with the very same fire from the Confederates and the very same effect. They broke and fell back into the swale. The third line advanced, Burnside's Hope. It didn't even get as far as the first two lines before it broke and fell back. The entire attack was over in just 45 minutes. One in every four Union soldiers who entered that field had become a casualty. General Burnside should have learned something from this. Instead, he ordered a second assault, which failed. So he ordered a third assault, followed by a fourth assault, followed by a fifth assault, followed by a sixth, and a seventh. Seven major attacks against this spot. And not one Union soldier ever got to the stone wall or the sunken road. The closest the Union Army ever got to this spot was about 50 yards straight ahead. It was a complete futile effort. For the soldiers who were trapped along the swale as they attempted to fire back at the Confederates, all they could hear were their bullets pinging off the stone wall, knowing that there was no damage that they could do to the Confederates. That became tremendously demoralizing, and they thought that this was the perfect Confederate defense.
The next stop focuses on the experiences of Confederate General Thomas Cobb. There's a marker along the sunken road just across from the Martha Stevens house site that marks the location of Cobb's mortal wounding. Focus on that spot. And Frank will talk about how, in fact, this was not such a perfect position for the Confederates.
But it's not perfect. In fact, one of the problems is right here where we are. Because on December 13th, there was a large house, Martha Stevens' house, and it stood in front of the lines. And it was a perfect target for Union artillery to zero their cannon in on. They hit it repeatedly during the battle. And at one critical moment, a shell would penetrate the back wall, bounce through the hall, and kick out the front door and burst right here in the yard. At that moment, two Confederate generals fell almost instantaneously. One was a North Carolina commander from the top of the hill, a brigadier general named John Rogers Cook, who was struck square in the middle of his forehead by a bullet. At that instant, General Cobb fell with a big piece of shrapnel sunk deep into his left thigh. The strange thing here is General Cook, struck in the head, was all right. He'd be back in command in just a couple of weeks. But General Cobb, struck in the leg, had a much more serious wound. The shrapnel had cut the femoral artery. General Cobb bled to death about 20 minutes later. Even as they tried to evacuate him away from the sunken road, General Cobb already knew he was beyond help because he delayed his departure. He repeatedly stopped his stretcher along the sunken road to give the troops pep speeches, telling them, "It's all right, boys, I'm only wounded. You fight on." And they did. Now, this is a crisis, because when a unit loses its leader, it loses direction. When you take out the only two Confederate generals on this road, you're going to have to replace them. Other generals will come here, other commanding officers, and they too will find themselves shot at some point. Among the different brigade and regimental commanders along the sunken road on December 13th, there were 22 officers in charge of these men. Of those 22, 18 of them wound up as casualties before the day was over. The stone wall may have protected the soldiers firing along it, but it did not protect the officers who stood behind them. This creates a crisis in command. When the troops lose direction, they also lose their will to function. But did anybody notice that the Confederates' fire slackened or it failed? It didn't happen. And that is attributable to General Cobb, because Cobb set up these relays before the battle even started. It was as if he anticipated a problem further down the road. Officers are needed when the situation changes. They have to adjust the men to it. But Cobb anticipated this, and they don't need to change anything. They're like a well-oiled machine that he got started, and it runs without his direction. So in this case, we had a crisis. It was abated simply by anticipating. There is another problem, a much more serious problem, right beside us at the Ennis House.
From the Cobb Monument and the Stevens House, just walk down the pathway to the Ennis House, the Clabber Building, just a few dozen yards to the north. Once there, turn your machine back on.
Okay, where we're located right now is in front of the Ennis House. The Ennis House is very special and unique because if you look very carefully at it, it still has a lot of its original 1862 siding to it. There are a number of holes throughout that siding, up by the door, between the windows, over in the lean-to, and they're bullet holes, of course. But here's the problem. Where did those bullets come from? Those bullets actually came from behind you. You're looking at an example of friendly fire. And these are the bullets that ranged high. There were a number of other bullets that landed a lot lower. They landed in the road among the Georgians who were located right here. In fact, of all the units along the sunken road, the unit that had the single highest concentration of loss was the troops that were located right here. When the battle opened up, they thought they were the safest soldiers because they not only had a stone wall to protect them, but they had a house in front of them to deflect fire as well. They found that that was not true. The house wasn't much of a help. In fact, it was a great hindrance. Confederate sharpshooters located in the house used the back windows to fire at the Union Army, and the Union troops responded by peppering the house and around it. And some of their bullets probably ranged right through if they hit it just right. But most of the bullet holes you're looking at came from Confederate fire. Troops who were located on top of Marie's Heights, in their enthusiasm, they had a tendency to fire low. It got so bad here that no less than 3 Georgia soldiers risked their lives to run a gauntlet of fire and run up to the top of the hill to beg those Confederates up there to adjust their fire. They asked them to fire higher. They asked them to fire to the side. The third one suggested that they just don't fire at all. Now, this is a serious problem because there are degrees of fire that soldiers have to endure. When there is a person in front of you who is your enemy trying to kill you, that's unnerving. But you can see them and you can fight back. When your enemy is beside you or behind you, they have a clear advantage, and that becomes demoralizing. But the worst type of fire is when you know exactly who is behind you and they are your friends, and there is nothing you can do about it. So how do they overcome a difficult situation here? In this particular case, they have to simply just weather the storm. They have to endure until the Confederates on the hilltop adjust their fire. It doesn't happen very easily. In fact, 3 soldiers have to run up the hill before they get something that works. In the interim, potentially the most demoralized unit on the entire sunken road would have been standing right here by the Innes House. If there was a weak link along the Confederate defense where troops were likely to break, it would have been right at this spot. But the Union Army was never the wiser, and they never exploited it, and the unit here never broke. So here was a crisis that they overcame simply by gritting their teeth. But I dare say that there wasn't a single Confederate that was located here by the Innes House that would have ever thought of the sunken road as the perfect defense. It was anything but perfect. But by their sacrifice, they make it appear overall to be ideal. The Union Army launched 7 major attacks against this spot. Not one of them had any promise of success. Remember, these attacks started with the idea that they would give the Union Army south of Fredericksburg a chance at succeeding by keeping these Confederates preoccupied. But the last assault on the southern end of the battlefield ended at 2:30 in Union defeat. And yet the Union Army continued to attack this spot from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock. But there was a reason that they did that. And that is because all the failed assaults that had preceded them, the Union soldiers had completely lost their organization. Their units had fractured out in the open field. They had become pinned down. They had lost their leadership. And they became very vulnerable, particularly to a Confederate counterattack. And there became a pervasive fear among the Union Army that the Confederates could easily sweep them off the field, back through the city of Fredericksburg, and right into the Rappahannock River. As the day goes on, even Burnside begins to feel that concern. The only way the Union commander could make sure that the Confederates would never counterattack is to make sure that they never got the chance to. Rather than yield the initiative to Robert E. Lee, the Union Army continued to hold on to the initiative by continuing their attacks. The best way to keep the Confederates on their side of the stone wall is to make sure that they were receiving an attack instead of launching an attack. So as the afternoon unwinds, the Union Army was trading lives for the ultimate life of the Army itself. Their goal was no longer to win at Fredericksburg, but to survive Fredericksburg and fight another day. The last assault went off at 6 o'clock. The sun set behind Marye's Heights, and it became too dark to continue. The Army of the Potomac had survived, but badly beaten for its result.
For the final stop and Frank's concluding remarks, proceed down the sunken road to the section of original stone wall just in front of the Kirkland Memorial. Here, Frank will wrap up the battle.
Before we part, there are a couple things I want to point out about the ground around us. The stone wall here is an original section of the stone wall that's been untouched, or relatively untouched, since the time of the battle. It's the same rocks that the Georgians leveled their rifles across on December 13th, as they mowed down wave after wave of Union attackers. You'll notice how the ground rises right up to the top of the wall. And thus, this is the section of Sunken Road that gives the road its true name. The Confederates who were behind this wall were perfectly protected. Very few casualties occurred in this area. Outside of the road was an entirely different matter. Where Union soldiers got closest to the wall was also right here in front of that original section, and their losses were abysmal. The closer they got, the more men that fell. But for those behind the stone wall, this was also an unsavory position. On the top of the hill, you'll see a large building with white pillars on it. That is known as Brompton. It was the home of the Marees, and thus giving their name to the entire area as Marees Heights. A beautiful mansion, but also another great target for Union soldiers to zero their fire in. Among Union and Confederate soldiers and units on the battlefield at Fredericksburg, the unit that suffered the single highest loss of commanding officers was a Confederate unit located right in front of that house. The 3rd South Carolina Infantry lost 7 commanding officers at Fredericksburg in almost as many minutes, simply because that house helped the Union Army target those officers. And so, depending on where you stand, the closer you got to the Union Army, being in the Sunken Road, you were perfectly safe. The further you step away from them and up the hill, you became a big and obvious target. And that became the deadliest part of the field for the Confederates in this sector. One last thing to look at, and that is the large monument in front of the stone wall. And this is to a sergeant from South Carolina named Richard Roland Kirkland. Kirkland was one of the soldiers behind the stone wall on December 13th and watched these soldiers from the north get mowed down. And then he also heard the cries of the wounded trapped in no man's land begging for water. At the risk of his own life, Sergeant Kirkland jumped the stone wall and brought water to the Union soldiers. There's a profound passage that tells us that there is no greater love in the world than a man who's willing to risk his life for his brother. But Kirkland didn't do that. He risked his life for his enemy. And that was truly sublime. For that, he was called the Angel of Marees Heights and was given one of the largest monuments on the entire battlefield, not to any military event or prowess whatsoever, but the simple act of compassion and humanity. It's quite a legacy for a man who was only 19 years old and a man who would not survive the war. Sergeant Kirkland was a fatality of this war. He was killed at the Battle of Chickamauga in September of 1863. He only had 9 months to live when he performed this incredibly selfless act at Fredericksburg.
To hear some concluding thoughts from Frank O'Reilly about the Battle of Fredericksburg, continue on to the next track on your player.
General Burnside never renewed the attack against this spot. On December 14th and 15th, the armies stared at each other, waiting for somebody to begin the fighting again. But under cover of darkness, on the evening of December 15th, the Union Army slipped back across the river, pulled up their pontoon bridges, and ended the Fredericksburg campaign. What we had was one of the great milestones of the American Civil War. We had the worst embarrassment, greatest defeat that the Lincoln administration had suffered to date in the American Civil War. When Lincoln heard about Fredericksburg, he said, "If there is a place worse than hell, I am in it." It jeopardized the very chance of holding the Emancipation Proclamation together. Of the 4 field armies that Lincoln had, 3 of them lost in the winter of 1862, but nobody lost worse than Burnside. It's the 4th Army that won a Pyrrhic victory in Tennessee at a place called Murfreesboro or Stones River, where the Union Army was able to cling to the battlefield after several tenacious days of fighting. When the Confederates withdrew, that was victory enough to preserve and protect the Emancipation Proclamation. Lincoln told the commander in Tennessee, William Rosecrans, "You have saved the Republic," because it was here at Fredericksburg that the Republic was most in jeopardy. But what happens at Fredericksburg resonates well beyond the winter of 1862. It affects and impacts the way the soldiers think and act from here on out. Because the other great milestone of this can be measured 2 ways. One is by numbers. The casualties here were decidedly one-sided. At Fredericksburg, the Union Army lost 13,000 men. The Confederates lost a little over 4,000 to 5,000 men. It doesn't get more one-sided than that during the war. It also impacts the morale of both armies. Confederate morale goes to an all-time high after Fredericksburg, and Union morale bottoms out and plummets. They will never be further apart during this entire war. Confederates felt that they were absolutely unstoppable after this battle at Fredericksburg. They felt that they were sanctioned by a higher power, because the night after the battle, they were treated to an amazing light show here, the Aurora Borealis, the Northern Lights. Rarely seen in these parts, but here it was, and it was on the battlefield. And Confederate after Confederate would write about it with great enthusiasm, talking about heaven's fireworks, celebrating their victory. Across the field were over 100,000 Union soldiers under that exact same sky. But very, very few of them ever mentioned the Aurora Borealis. Only two of them that I know of wrote of it at the time it occurred. One of them, a man from Maine, simply wrote in his diary, 6:15 p.m., Aurora. And that was it. No deeper meaning, no greater symbolism. And in and of itself, that's very revealing and very reflective of their morale. Because Confederates are looking at the sky and divining their future. But Union soldiers aren't. Union soldiers were looking at this open field where they left 8,000 of their friends and family, colleagues and comrades, wounded and dead.
That concludes Frank's tour of the Sunken Road. From here, in front of the original stone wall, just return back down the road to the south to the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center. We thank you very much for coming. We thank you very much for caring about your national parks.